I'm turning now to the book of the prophet Jeremiah, chapter 39 and verse 1. Jeremiah, chapter 39 and verse 1. In the ninth year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the tenth month, came Nebuchadrezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army against Jerusalem, and they besieged it. So began the 30-month siege. All the days and the months and the years are given to weaken the city, to create starvation within, to weaken the troops, the city that was so confident it could outlast a siege and defend itself would fall. And as we proceed in verse 2, in the 11th year, the last year of Zedekiah, in the fourth month, the ninth day of the month, the city was broken up, and all the princes of the king of Babylon came in and sat in the middle gate. And there are all the Babylonian names now in command in the city. In the middle gate, half the city was occupied, the other half then gradually and inevitably cleared of all danger. And in verse 4, we'll just read these passages to begin with. And it came to pass that when Zedekiah, the king of Judah, saw them and all the men of war, the Israelite soldiers, then they fled and went forth out of the city by night by the way of the king's garden, by the gate betwixt the two walls. And he went out, Zedekiah, the way of the plain. But the Chaldeans' army pursued after them. They went by night, but they were soon spotted, and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. And when they had taken him, they brought him up to Nebuchadrezzar, king of Babylon, to Riblah, in the land of Hamath, where he gave judgment upon him. Treated him as a criminal, because he'd broken his oath of allegiance to the Chaldean king. And so the full details of this are reproduced in chapter 52 from verses 4 to 8 and later in the chapter at great length. And this is just a summary here in this position in chapter 39. But you read of how the children of Zedekiah were taken. The sons of Zedekiah must all have been, I should imagine, under 12, because he was only 32 when this took place. And his wives, because he had multiple wives, and all were taken. And he kept his life, but his eyes were put out, and he was captive in Babylon for the remainder of his life. So Jerusalem fell in accordance with the prophecy of Jeremiah and other prophecies before that. It fell. The people had been warned repeatedly, but they hadn't listened. They'd be given opportunity to repent and return to the true worship and abandon their idolatry, but they refused. Zedekiah had been warned repeatedly, right up to the 11th hour, and the prophecies had been laid out before him. If you defect to the Chaldeans and renew your oath, you'll be preserved alive and the city will be preserved. But if you fail to, if the Chaldeans take this city, they will destroy it. You will keep your life, the prophecy says, but you'll lose everything else, and the city will be lost, and the nation state will lose its status. And that is exactly what took place and what happened. But in these chapters, we can proceed quite quickly in through these chapters this evening. We'll see some remarkable things which have ongoing lessons for God's people in every age. And I'm just going to go down to chapter 39 and verse 5. I've read it already. The Chaldean army pursued after them and overtook Zedekiah. In verses 6 to 7 of chapter 39, there is the summary of his punishment, elaborated on later in the book. In verse 7, he put out Zedekiah's eyes and bound him with chains to carry him to Babylon. And then in verse 10, a most intriguing thing, but Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, left off the poor of the people which had nothing in the land of Judah, and gave them vineyards and fields at the same time. So the poverty-stricken in the city were actually given territories in the land nearby. And Zebuzaradan showed much more compassion as a Chaldean prince than their own rulers had done on them. In this chapter 39, verses 15 and so on, are a flashback to an earlier thing. I'm going to pass over them and go to chapter 40 and the first verses in the chapter. The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord after the captain of the guard, Zebuzaradan, had let him go from Ramah when he had taken him being bound in chains. And Jeremiah prophesies once the city has fallen. But look at the action of the captain of the guard, verse 2. He took Jeremiah and said unto him, "The Lord thy God hath pronounced this evil upon this place." The Chaldeans knew it. They knew all about Jeremiah's ministry. They rehearsed to him his own predictions. Verse 3, "Now the Lord hath brought it and done according as he hath said, because ye have sinned against the Lord and have not obeyed his voice, therefore this thing is come upon you. And now behold," verse 4, "I loose thee this day from the chains which were upon thine hand." So Jeremiah, we're told earlier, is to be released by order of Nebuchadnezzar, who knows he's a prophet, who knows he's been urging the people to yield, and who is now specifically delivered from the general judgment and result of the fall of Jerusalem. And the captain of the guard gives him a choice. "If it seem good unto thee to come with me into Babylon, come, and I will look well unto thee. But if it seem ill unto thee to come with me into Babylon, forbear. Behold, all the land is before thee." So Jeremiah is given free passage, wherever he wishes to go, whatever he wants to do. Of course, really, he's not terribly free. He can't go where there is nothing and where there is nobody. He's got to choose either between defecting to the Chaldeans and going to Babylon himself, or going with the remnant that remains in the land. And in verse 5, "Now while he was not yet gone back, he said, Go back also to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, whom the king of Babylon hath made governor over the cities of Judah." So Gedaliah is going to be governor over all the Israelites that remain in the towns and villages in Judah around Jerusalem. Jerusalem is destroyed. It's uninhabitable. But a governor is appointed. And it's interesting, the basis of this appointment must be that Gedaliah had obeyed Jeremiah. He'd gone to Babylon. He'd defected to the Chaldeans. He'd rallied many of his own people and ordered them. And this is possibly his reward. He's not a prince in Judah. He's not of royal blood. He's not a descendant of David. But he's given from Nebuchadnezzar control over the land of Judah as governor on his behalf. So the captain of the guard, end of verse 5, gave Jeremiah victuals, provisions, and a reward, whatever that might mean, and let him go. And Jeremiah went unto Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, to Mizpah, the city which he made his headquarters, a comparatively small but central place. And then, verse 7, when all the captains of the forces which were in the fields, the defeated Israelites, the straggling remnant of men left all over the place, even they and their men heard that the king of Babylon had made Gedaliah the son of Ahikam governor in the land, and had committed unto him men and women and children, and of the poor of the land, and of them that were not carried away to Babylon, then they all rallied to Gedaliah, also to Mizpah. And the notes are given of who gathered together. And verse 9 and 10 are the details of how Gedaliah told them the terms of his rule and what they must do. And they were free to farm the land and to do whatever they wished. But there was going to be an enormous problem, and we come to it very soon. Now, perhaps I can go down to verse 12 of chapter 40. Even all the Jews returned out of all places whither they were driven, came to the land of Judah to Gedaliah unto Mizpah, and gathered wine and summer fruits very much. But listen to this, chapter 40, verse 13. Moreover, Johanan, the son of Kareah, and all the captains of the forces that were in the fields, came to Gedaliah to Mizpah, and said unto him, this is Johanan, dost thou certainly know that Baalis, the king of the Ammonites, hath sent Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, to slay thee? But Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, believed them not. Now, this is very interesting. The Ammonites, who still evidently felt that Babylon could be brought down and that there ought to be a proper liaison between Judah and Moab and Ammon and all the smaller states in the region, and that Nebuchadnezzar ought to be resisted, was so furious that a governor over Judah had been appointed, that he arranged for this man Ishmael to go and assassinate him. What Ishmael was promised, I don't know. Some significant place in among the Ammonites. He shouldn't have cooperated with them. It was a grossly wrong thing for him to do, but he did. But there's more to this, you know, because this Ishmael was of royal blood. He was a minor royal. He was related to Zedekiah the king. He was in the line of David. And one wonders whether not only was he being put up to this by the king of the Ammonites, but he himself was bitter and jealous that Gedaliah, a non-royal, somebody who had no place, not even a prince of Judah, should be appointed to this role. Very capable man and a godly man and a good man, Gedaliah. But that cut no ice with Ishmael, and he possibly was jealous of him also. But this plot seems to be well known. Johanan says to Gedaliah, don't you know about this? That's the way it's put in the record. Haven't you heard about this? And Gedaliah doesn't believe him. Now that's very puzzling. Why not? And Ishmael comes, and somehow Johanan isn't there. He's taken his forces, his troops away somewhere. He hasn't vigilantly remained in Mizpah, and so Gedaliah is rather exposed. And Ishmael comes with a mere 10 men. Now you can see why he used so few. If he'd come to Mizpah with a force of even 100, it may well have aroused instant suspicions. But he's got 10 men, and they're obviously hand-picked. And they come, and they're given hospitality by Gedaliah, who has no suspicions whatsoever, won't believe the report that he's about to be assassinated, has refused to let Johanan go and make a preemptive strike and capture this man. But he comes, and he gives him a meal. He has full Eastern hospitality. They're all at peace. And of course, at this meal with his 10 men, he suddenly flies up, destroys Gedaliah, everybody else in sight, many others also, and then, well, that's it. The governor appointed by the king of Babylon is no more. Now, Jeremiah is there in the mix somewhere. Nobody addresses him, nobody calls for him. This is something God has obviously intimated to him would happen, and it's unavoidable, so all is quiet as far as Jeremiah is concerned. But then the record goes on to tell us, and I won't read the verses, how 80 or so pilgrims are on their way to the burned out Jerusalem from other parts of the land with great sorrow to go to Jerusalem to pay their respects and so on. And they're sidetracked by Ishmael, and they're executed too, and put in a great pit that had been previously dug for quite another purpose. And so the question arises, how did he get away with this? Why did he do this? Why did Gedaliah not believe the intelligence? Why did he allow it to happen? Well, he was a good man, but you can start by saying he plainly became very overconfident. He'd never been a governor. He'd never had such a dizzy position before. Maybe though he was a good man, it went to his head a little. And so he was unguarded and foolish. Maybe, he said to himself, yes, but I've been appointed by Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. Nobody's going to lay a hand on me because they'll have to answer to the Babylonian emperor. And that's an absurd position to put yourself into. So maybe that made him feel secure and safe. Maybe, well, he clearly would have known Ishmael, but perhaps he liked him. And so because he liked him, that's a possibility. He discounted any report about his coming as an assassin. And maybe he just completely underestimated the force of evil and the forces against him. And he thought he could cope with anything that would arise. He was not suspicious. He, not in the least. He just underestimated. These are spiritual matters. The preservation of that nation, because the Messiah was due to come in due course. And all these things, he just didn't appreciate. There would be satanic hostility and activity, and anything might happen. And that happens today. Christian people underestimate the force of sin. They dabble with certain things that are wrong, both as individuals and as churches. Adopt things, go into for things, associate with things which they know are wrong. And they underestimate the power of these things to take over and to hold and to grip. And I'm sure you're seeing something like this going on so long ago. So a good man falls prey to an assassin because he doesn't believe the intelligence that he receives. Let me go on to chapter 41 and verse 1. Now it came to pass in the seventh month that Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, the son of Elishama, of the seed royal, and the princes of the king, even 10 men with him, came unto Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, to Mizpah. And there they did eat bread together in Mizpah. Then arose Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah. And that is what I've been explaining to you at the beginning of chapter 41. There was the assassination and all the troubles that followed. Now I'm coming down to verse 11 of chapter 41, where we read that when Jehanan, the son of Kareah, and all the captains of the forces that were with him, heard of all the evil that Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, had done, then they took all the men and went to fight with Ishmael. They found him by the great waters that are in Gibeon. And it came to pass that all the people that had been rounded up by Ishmael were delivered, but Ishmael himself got away from Jehanan. That's the record. And then Jehanan had a problem. There he was now, the senior man, with all the people that had gathered together Gedaliah, a very considerable number of them. He was the head of the remnant of forces of Judah. And would the same, would the king of Babylon's allowing them to live in peace in the land, would it extend to him? Now that Gedaliah had been executed, assassinated, or would they suffer a Chaldean invasion? King of Babylon would come and destroy him and them for executing his appointed regional governor. So they've got a great problem on their hands, and they're afraid with a great number of people for their own lives. And so up to this point, they haven't asked Jeremiah what the Lord would say about any of these things, but now they're obviously sufficiently alarmed to come to him and to ask him. So in chapter 42, at long last, then all the captains of the forces of Jehanan, the son of Kareah, and Jezaniah, the son of Hoshaiah, and all the people from the least even unto the greatest. It was a great convocation, and their representatives came near, and they said unto Jeremiah the prophet, "Let, we beseech thee, our supplication be accepted before thee, and pray for us unto the Lord thy God, even for all this remnant. For we are left but a few of many, as thine eyes do behold us, that the Lord thy God may show us the way wherein we may walk." Why didn't they do this before? "And the thing that we may do." Then Jeremiah the prophet said unto them, "I have heard you. Behold," this is verse 4 of chapter 42, "I will pray unto the Lord your God according to your words, and it shall come to pass that whatsoever thing the Lord shall answer you, I will declare it unto you. I will keep nothing back from you." It seems to be the hint in these words. You're going to get a message you don't want and you don't like. We'll wait for it, but I can tell you now, you won't want it. That surely is the tone. Then they said to Jeremiah, this is one of the most extraordinary things in the whole of the book of Jeremiah, "The Lord be a true and faithful witness between us, if we do not even according to all the things for which the Lord thy God shall send thee to us, whether it be good or whether it be evil, we will obey the voice of the Lord our God, to whom we send thee, that it may be well with us when we obey the voice of the Lord our God." So they make a solemn pledge, and they commit themselves, whether it's good news or bad news, they will obey the prophet. He didn't ask them to do that. They volunteer this tremendous pledge and commitment, an oath, that they're going to listen and they're going to obey. Well, there's a 10-day wait for the Lord's word, and that was probably intentional on the Lord's part, obviously, to underscore the fact that these are not Jeremiah's words. He's dependent upon the word of the Lord. And the word of the Lord came unto Jeremiah, verse 8, "Then called he Johanan, the son of Kareah, and all the captains of the forces that were with him," another great gathering and convocation. And here is the message, verse 10. "If ye will still abide in this land, then will I build you and not pull you down, and plant you and not pluck you up. For I repent me," the Lord using words accommodated to the understanding of the people, "I have changed my action of the evil that I have done unto you. Be not afraid of the king of Babylon, of whom ye are afraid. Be not afraid of him, saith the Lord, for I am with you to save you and to deliver you from his hand, and I will show mercies upon you." And verse 13, "But if ye say, we will not dwell in this land, neither obey the voice of the Lord your God, we will go into the land of Egypt. That'll be much better for us. There'll be peace there and plenty to eat. If that's what you decide," verse 15, "now hear the word of the Lord, ye remnant of Judah," because Egypt will in fact be destroyed, and the king of Babylon will lay it waste, and you shall die there. So don't go into Egypt. This is, of course, exactly what happened. This is a matter of history, the fall of Egypt to Babylon. And so Jeremiah gives them every opportunity to settle in the land. Verse 19, he repeats himself, "The Lord hath said concerning you, O ye remnant of Judah, go ye not into Egypt. Know certainly that I have admonished you this day. For ye dissembled in your hearts." Jeremiah actually knows it. Perhaps as he gave his message, their faces were angry and they didn't want to listen. So even before he's finished repeating his God's message to them, he's saying, "Ye dissembled, you put on a show," is the meaning of the term in this context. "You put on a show when you came and you said all these things about your obedience, when you said you'd listen and you'd do it." Verse 21, "And now I have declared this day, I have this day declared it to you, but ye have not obeyed the voice of the Lord your God. Before they say anything, their faces surely betray it. Now you'll certainly die, because you refused the word of the Lord. And that's what takes place. Of course, they should have known that they should never have gone to Egypt. Way back in the time of Moses, that's made very clear. Deuteronomy chapter 17 and verse 16. Return to Egypt historically at any time is absolutely forbidden. Not so much longer before, Isaiah had made a very lengthy prophecy not to go to Egypt. They mustn't do that. And we have an equivalent. Don't turn to the world for help. You're the Church of Jesus Christ. Don't borrow the world's music, the world's methods, the world's devices. Don't do it. It's the modern equivalent of going down to Egypt for help. Anyway, they're not going to listen to Jeremiah in spite of their big words. Mind you, we can do that today. I know churches that do this. They use a lot of slogans. They say, come and listen to us. And they're Bible believers. Come and listen to us. We give you the word good and strong and faithful and true and apply it correctly. They like to speak up, talk up their ministries. And yet there's all kinds of things where they just will not obey the word. And they fool themselves, just as these people were doing. Strong undertakings of obedience and loyalty. But as soon as the message comes, we're not listening to that. It wasn't the one they wanted, so they refuse it. And we have to make sure we don't fall into the same kind of trap. Just look down to some of the things we read here. Chapter 44 I'll go to, and verse 15. Chapter 43 gives the terrible reply, and we could examine it at length. But I'm going to chapter 44, verse 15, first of all. Then all the men which knew that their wives had burned incense unto other gods, and all the women that stood by, a great multitude, even all the people that dwelt in the land of Egypt, they've moved now, they've disobeyed Jeremiah, they've gone to Egypt. Of course he's had to go with them. They've taken him as well. They're in Pathros. They answered Jeremiah, saying, as for the word that thou hast spoken unto us in the name of the Lord, we will not hearken unto thee. They've already said, we don't believe you're an authentic prophet. But we will certainly do whatsoever thing goeth forth out of our own mouth. And we're going to go on burning incense unto the Queen of Heaven, and worshipping our idols, and pour out our drink offerings to her, as we've done in the past. And this is the reason, end of verse 17. For then had we plenty of victuals, and were well, and saw no evil. So it's the pragmatic form of argument, using the term in a philosophical sense. We'll do what works for us. We're not interested in your words, your message, your teaching. We'll do what works for us. While we were idolaters, we had prosperity. Of course, it's nonsense reasoning, because they didn't have. The Chaldeans were likely to strike at any time. They were in great fear and insecurity. But that's not how they choose to see it when they justify themselves. They say, while we were engaging in idolatry, everything went very well, and we were fine. So they talk their way into their point of view, the pragmatic form of argument. And that's what even Bible believers often use. It's a tragedy. The pragmatic form of argument. You say this is not biblical, this is not right, we shouldn't do this or that, but it works for us. Or so they imagine. Or so they think it does. But of course it doesn't. It'll bring things into disrepair, as it did these people. What an argument to use. When we were idolaters, we were well off. Look at them. They're now in Egypt. They've lost their capital. They've lost their cities. They can't stay in their country, so they think. And they've fled to Egypt, of all places. And they're saying, well, before all this happened, we were all right. So what we were doing was not offensive. It was a reasonable thing to do. They can't reason straight. And this pragmatic form of argument fogs the reasoning. And we see it even today. But I won't go into all that. We have occasion to speak of it often. Look at chapter 44, verse 23. Because ye have burned incense, says Jeremiah, because ye have sinned against the Lord and have not obeyed the voice of the Lord, nor walked in his law, nor in his statutes, nor in his testimonies, therefore this evil is happened unto you as this day. And then there is the great prediction which follows concerning the destruction of Egypt also. Let me just take you back for a moment for chapter 43 and verse 2, where there's a little word which I've passed over. In opposing Jeremiah, then spake Azariah, the son of Hoshiah, and Johanan, the son of Kareah, and all the proud men, saying unto Jeremiah, thou speakest falsely. The proud men. That's an interesting little term. All the proud men. That Hebrew word, here translated proud, comes from the verb to seethe. To seethe. It's a special kind of pride. Somebody who gets very angry and resentful if corrected. He resents correction. He resents the challenge of God. He resents instruction. He wants what he wants. It's a branch of pride. And pride blocks the reason, denies the authority of God, denies Jeremiah, who is a proven prophet. Everything he said has come to pass. Generates endless excuses, self-justification. It grows and grows. And these are proud men. And that's why they react as they do. They're not going to be corrected. So I'm going on to chapter 45. And we'll just look at this chapter and I'll start to come to conclusion. The word that Jeremiah the prophet spake unto Baruch, the son of Neriah, when he had written these words in a book at the mouth of Jeremiah, in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, saying. Now this is here another kind of flashback. This goes way back to 605 BC. And it speaks of Baruch. And Baruch was the scribe who wrote out all the prophecies of Jeremiah. All his messages, everything he said, was written out by Baruch. But this has a terrible effect upon Baruch. He's a godly man, we believe. Verse 2, there's a message for him. Thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, unto thee, O Baruch, thou didst say, woe is me now, for the Lord hath added grief to my sorrow. I fainted in my sighing, and I find no rest. What is all this about? Well, evidently, in even taking down the prophecies of Jeremiah, that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed, the land is going to fall, the people will continue obdurate and disobedient up to the bitter end. In taking all this down, he's overwhelmed. And he's plunged into deep despair and depression. And he doesn't want to believe it. Well, that's kind of understandable. It's all so dismal. The people have so sinned. And he's the person who has to write it all down. But here's the message of God to him, verse 4 of chapter 45. Thus shalt thou say unto him, the Lord saith thus, behold, that which I have built will I break down, and that which I have planted I will pluck up, even this whole land. Well, Baruch knew that. That's what he'd written down at great length, all the prophecies of Jeremiah. But it is as though the Lord is saying to him, how dare you be crushed or dismayed or unhappy? It might be a terrible message because the people have sinned, but it is my will. This is the climax of centuries of patience with a disobedient people. I have given this word, so you do not have to recoil from it. But then there's another reason why Barak didn't care for this message, even though he was a godly man, and was so depressed by it. Because it turns out that even though he was a good man, there was in his heart a desire for something for himself. As if he said, I am Barak. I am the scribe of all the prophecies of Jeremiah. This will make me important. This gives me status and station. This makes me significant. But nobody wants to listen to these prophecies. Jeremiah is the most unpopular man in the land. With the king, with the princes, only a few people faithful to him. Everybody's, and that means they're rejecting me too. I am his scribe. I am his recorder, his writer. And that's not what he wanted. Look at the rest of the chapter, this last verse, verse 5. And seekest thou great things for thyself? Seek them not. So God reproves him. Because although he's a good man, he was rather looking forward to being very significant and being appreciated for all his toils. For behold, I will bring evil upon all flesh, saith the Lord. But he does make a promise to Barak. But thy life will I give unto thee for a prey in all places whither thou goest. Wherever you are, whatever happens, whoever's against you, I will preserve you and keep you. But that's not an inconsiderable promise. But what an interesting word. Seekest thou great things for thyself? Seek them not. Pride. We have our biggest battle with pride. Somebody can conquer pride as a Christian when they're young. And if they're not watchful, it'll come back with a vengeance when they're older. Sometimes it's the other way round. Pride and something for me strikes much more in youth. And maybe we get control of it as we get older and we put the Lord first and his priorities. But pride will strike, and if Satan can, he wants every Christian man or woman to put himself first. Something for me. My career. Well, it's a good thing, obviously, to be diligent and to work and to accomplish things. That's all good. And to be so trusted that whatever your line of business or your profession, you end up successful. If the Lord can trust you with success, then he will measure it to you. If you can keep your Christian priorities, if you can still put him first, no matter what. But it's tragic for a Christian if my ambition or desire to be approved or applauded or special becomes my priority. And that seems to be what happened to Barak. It's a terrible form of pride, ambition for me. When you're young and you're designing your career and your studies and so on, you pray to be kept in check. This is a great motto text. We can't give it to anybody when they join the church as a motto text. Obviously, that would be insensitive. That would suggest to the whole church that we think this person is in trouble and heading into trouble. But it's a very good motto text for everyone to have in the cover of their Bible. And when you've got a big decision or a big planning episode ahead of you or something like that, consult it. This is the verse, chapter 45, verse 5. Seekest thou great things for thyself? Seek them not. It's very precious. It will deliver you from 10,000 snares and keep you close to the Lord to listen to this and keep your priorities right. It's so important. Ambition can cause such troubles. What comes to mind is a curious case for me to mention here on this side of the Atlantic. But in the 19th century, there was a very famous man in the United States of America who was a lawyer and a politician named Salmon Portland Chase. Any of you who studied American history, you'll know a little bit about him. Very, very handsome man, a big fellow, with burning ambition. He did, in the course of his life, become U.S. Secretary to the Treasury, and at a very important time. This doesn't really concern us here, but he was the man who brought in the paper money system into America. They never had it properly organized on a federal scale before he did it. And he was the man who made all the regulations all those years ago for the banks when they were rapidly being created. But early on, a little bit earlier on in his life, when he was in his late 40s, I believe, he stood for president and he was beaten to the Republican nomination by Abraham Lincoln. So that'll give you some idea when he was. And after Abraham Lincoln was elected president, he promptly brought him into his cabinet. So he was, but he was an interesting man because his father was a very well-to-do farmer who had a huge house, like a mansion. It was yellow in colour. And all the people used to say that there were more brains born into that house than any other in the state, in the region. So his family were clever people. His father actually went bankrupt. Because he went in for a great industrial investment, which went wrong for various reasons. But he was a godly man. And they said he was such a nice chap, the father, and so godly. And the son believed himself to be a converted man also. But I can't tell you too much about him. We haven't time, apart from the fact that his father died when he was 9. And his mother had all the debts. So she farmed out all the children to relatives. There were 11 of them altogether. I think Salmon Chase, Salmon, it's an interesting name, isn't it? There's another digression on a digression, but it used to be a very popular name in America. And the L is sounded, although it's spelt the same as salmon. So it's a fishy name. However, it's a sort of truncated version of Solomon, which comes from the Hebrew for peace. Where was I? Anyway, what happened was that he was farmed out to an uncle who was an Episcopalian bishop. But he was a man who was determined that children had to be trained hard. So he worked all hours, swatting, studying, had to work on the family farmstead and all this kind of thing. And he believed in this, a man of iron discipline. Never swore, even as a youngster. Always kept the Lord's Day. They say he could recite whole books of the Bible, because all he read was the Bible on the Lord's Day. Did all his intensive study. Went to Dartmouth College, very famous in America, as you know. Became a lawyer, did the whole lawyer's course in half the usual time. Intense ambition. There was a lot of ambition in America in those days. Must succeed. So he took up the legal profession. And then he married. And he saw himself as a believer, but he married a lass who wasn't a believer. And this girl was very outgoing, beautiful, beautiful young woman, and everybody thought she was very, very nice. They'd been married 18 months, and she died in childbirth. But he wasn't there. He wasn't there because he'd gone to Philadelphia on legal business to... The great thing in his mind was to advance, and an opportunity arose that would considerably advance him. So he went to do this legal business, and when he came back, the door was covered with black crepe, the door of his mansion, which meant there was death in the house. And he found his wife had died. And he found the reason was that the physicians had overbled her. They bled her once, twice, three times, four times, until she couldn't take any more, and she died. He knew if he'd been there, he would never have allowed that. That kind of thing could happen. But there was something else. He didn't know whether she was saved. He thought she wasn't. They'd been married 18 months and they'd hardly ever talked about the faith. He shouldn't really have married her. But having married her, he was too busy. He had so much work. He had a huge practice. He was making a lot of money. He was taking on ever higher and higher cases and having to study for them. And when she died, he hadn't even had time to talk about the Lord. And it crushed him. It shattered him for almost 5 years before he had to have what he called a second conversion and some measure of peace. What was the trouble? Ambition. Ambition can get hold of you. Make a clever man, intensely clever man. Do foolish things. Get wrong priorities. Everything out of order. Curb it, dear friends. Take it in hand. The Lord is always first. Never forget that. I must close this verse. And seekest thou great things for thyself? Seek them not. Let's close this evening singing together the hymn.